It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A cloture vote is scheduled this morning in the United States Senate to close debate on the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. While this is not the confirmation vote itself, it will be a key indicator of whether Republicans have the necessary votes to approve Judge Kavanaugh. Special coverage begins here on the Ideas Network starting at 8:30 this morning. Now, though, we turn to a discussion about how we deal with sexual assault, what we expect from victims, and how that squares with our system and our ideas about justice. We want to hear from you. Have you or someone you know been affected by sexual assault? Did you try to report it? What happened? Did you choose not to tell anyone? What did you weigh when making that decision? Share your story, if you would, by calling 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Kelly Wills, an associate professor in the Division of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. She teaches communication, gender, sexuality, and women's studies. Kelly, welcome back to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
When Christine Blasey Ford came forward to accuse Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault when they were teens, some people wanted to know, why didn't she report it right away? Kelly, how do you make sense of that?
There are a number of reasons why survivors tend to either not report at all or wait a very long time. So let's just start with some numbers. So the best numbers that we have are that 1 in 5 women, roughly, and 1 in 13 men will be sexually assaulted at some point in their lifetime. The numbers for men are actually probably higher because there is such a greater stigma of men to report sexual assault. But less than 10% will ever report their assault either to their school or to the police if they're on a college campus. Of those who do, on average, they wait about 11 months to report. So again, it's far more likely that the victims will never come forward whatsoever. If you look at 2017 data, only 23% of incidents of rape and assault were reported to the police at all. And so again, it makes it the least likely victim or crime to be reported or even kind of tracked. And because of this underreporting, many types of federal surveys likely leave out millions of incidents. And so I want to just sort of kind of frame that there. So why would someone not report? Some want to protect their family. I'm not sure if you saw Connie Chung's letter to Dr. Ford this week, but essentially she was saying that this happened 50 years ago, her sexual assault, and is with the family doctor. You know, he was a family friend. Many times people just want to protect their families from that because that's a really hard conversation. Or if the perpetrator is a family member, that makes it likely that you're not going to report that either. Another reason may be that the person who assaulted you may be in a position of power over you. If we look at sexual assault in the military, for example, in many cases, if someone comes forward, the person actually considering the criminal charges may be the person who assaulted them. And so if you're a woman in the military currently, you are more likely to be sexually assaulted than to die in combat. And so a lot of issues have been happening within rape and assault in the military. Because of this, Claire McCaskill in 2015 sponsored a bill that would end the statute of limitations for rape cases in the military because this, so much was happening. And so, again, if the person who assaulted you is going to be the one in charge of your investigation, how likely are you to actually come forward? We also have a really narrow definition of what rape is. And so I think it's important to remember that we didn't even have a term for spousal rape until the 1970s, and it wasn't considered a crime until 1993. So if you were raped by your husband before 1993, there was no path for you to sort of go on in terms of claiming this was actually sexual assault, nor did you probably think that that was actually in the realm of sexual assault because that's a very specific type of rape, right? We tend to think of rape as, you know, something that happens in a dark alley with a knife, with a stranger. And again, those are really rare cases. It's far more likely that the person who assaults you is someone that you know. Also, many victims just don't believe in the criminal justice system, and there's good evidence to think that. So right now in 35 states, it is legal for police to detain and have sex with someone in their custody. In Oklahoma, it's legal to have oral sex with a victim who is unconscious. In North Carolina, a person cannot withdraw consent for sex once intercourse is taking place. So there are a number of reasons why the justice system isn't working. I think just this past week, I think this has gotten less attention, but a man in Virginia who tied up and sexually assaulted a 14-year-old girl is not facing any jail time. A doctor in Texas who raped and heavily sedated a patient was sentenced to 10 months probation and will serve no jail time. A man in Anchorage, Alaska, who pleaded guilty to assaulting and strangling a woman until she lost consciousness and then masturbated on her will also serve no jail time because he got a pass. That was a quote-unquote of a person who was accusing them. So, again, victims know that the criminal justice system that we have is probably not going to serve them effectively, so they tend to not report. I think the hashtag why I didn't report is really helpful right now. That was sort of trending last week. But again, it's a lot of reasons why people never want to come forward. For me personally, as a survivor of sexual assault, I was 18 years old. I had never had sex before. The person who assaulted me was a family friend. And I was far more concerned with, you know, am I pregnant? Do I have an STD? Versus getting justice or, you know, filing charges, right? And so, again, I think we should be asking in general, again, versus, you know, why didn't she report? You know, why did he sexually assault? Because overwhelmingly, this is a crime done by men to other women and to other men.
Well, and that goes to kind of the framing of the whole sexual assault discussion. The language that we use to talk about it really does make a difference in terms of giving a perspective. Talk a little bit about how we even have conversations about sexual assault and the language we use.
Yeah, so it's really important. I've heard the term due process a lot this week, right? And I think we have these two conflicting notions in our country, right, that a person should be innocent until proven guilty, but we also know how often sexual assault happens, and so we want to also believe survivors. And in many cases, those two things don't seem like they're mutually exclusive, right? So I think we need to think about when we are asking for due process, who we are asking due process for, and how we talk about this absolutely affects that. So when we talk about due process, you know, many people who are asking for due process for Justice Kavanaugh are the same who are maybe chanting lock her up in other instances, right? And so we aren't talking about due process for victims of sexual assault or critiquing the criminal justice system in terms of race and poverty. Rather, this narrative tends to rear its head when we talk about accusing specifically, you know, white men of a certain social class. And so I think it's interesting, the Central Park Five came up this week a lot. And if those who are unfamiliar with that, five young men of color in the 1980s were accused of rape and assault, even though none of the DNA matched at all. And it was overturned after some of them spent 13 years in jail. And so when we think about due process, I want us to think about who we are asking that deserves that due process. Are we only worried about due process when it's someone who is on our political team, or do we care about due process in the entire criminal justice system? So I think that's something we really have to think about as well. And so hopefully we can kind of consider that too.
Kelly Wills teaches communication, gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. By the way, if you or someone you know needs help, you can call the National Sexual Assault Hotline. That number is 800-656-4673, 800-656-4673. Wondering if you would like to add to our discussion here this morning as we have this conversation about sexual assault. Are you someone who's been affected by sexual assault? Did you try to report it? What happened? Did you choose not to tell anyone? What weighed into your decision? Share your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Again, my guest, Kelly Wills, Associate Professor in the Division of Communication at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Our conversation continues. This is The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about the way we view sexual assault, and we're listening to you. How has sexual assault affected your life? Do you worry if something happened whether anyone would believe you? Or is the system set up to protect victims? Are you conflicted about how we consider reports of sexual assault decades after they happen? What do you hope will come out of today's conversations? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kelly Wills is an associate professor in the Division of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. She teaches communication, gender, sexuality, and women's studies. We do have callers. Kelly, let's take a call from Lisa, who joins us from Janesville. Lisa, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. I just wanted to add that I reported an assault in 1986 that had happened a few years prior to that. I didn't plan on actually reporting it. I said something in a moment of upset, and it was reported. I was a teenager at 16 in 1986. The judge never spoke to me. I was never, at any rate, the person who assaulted me was given a choice of counseling or jail. And most people in the community didn't believe me. So I can't imagine in 1982 attending an all-girls Catholic school that she would have had anything to stand on. So, thank you.
Lisa, thank you for sharing your story. Kelly?
Yeah, I'm really sorry that you went through that. I think we're seeing right now a lot of women coming forward, whatever it may be, being either inspired by Dr. Ford's testimony. The number of women who have contacted me just in this past week just to say, this happened to me. I'm very open and public about my own sexual assault, and so people who are either friends of mine know that I am a safe place to discuss that with. But I think a lot of people are just, there's this sort of want to also give people witness to what happened to them. I think one of the most devastating things that happened this past week, a good friend of mine that I went to college with just sent me a message and said, this is a man who assaulted me. He's a semi-public figure. I just want someone to know that I told someone. I mean, she doesn't want to report, doesn't want to go to the police. But again, she wanted someone to bear witness to the fact that this happened, that this man did this to her back in college, right? And that she doesn't ever want to come forward. But in the off percent chance that maybe he becomes a Supreme Court justice one day, that maybe there's a record, right, or some sort of witness to that happening to her, because I think that obviously is what it took for Dr. Ford to come forward. She did not want to come forward. She was terrified. This was not, again, thinking about upending her life and getting death threats. That is not something that anyone would openly want in their life, right? And so for her to come forward at all, I tend to want to believe what happened, because it just makes so little sense that anyone would come forward after all these years if it weren't true. You almost have to be a masochist to want to come forward if it weren't true and have that happen to your life.
And we've seen cases, especially over the past year, where people have come forward about assaults that happened decades ago. How does that affect the severity of the accusations in people's minds? How do people react to that?
I think it depends on how many people you know who have been assaulted. I mean, I think statistically, it's impossible that you don't know someone who has been sexually assaulted. If we look at the 1 in 3 and 1 in 13, that's a really high number of people. And so I would say that if you don't know someone who has been sexually assaulted, it may be because they don't feel like you are a safe person to talk to. And so I think what tends to happen and what tends to sort of feed into a lot of these sort of rape myths is this idea that, you know, when we have a long history of viewing women as deceptive in general, right? We have, go back into Adam and Eve, we assume that women tend to not be truth tellers. And so when they come forward, we automatically assume the worst of the victim and assume the best of the person who's being accused. And so I think we need to sort of flip that on its head and sort of think about why it is that we are so unlikely to believe survivors of sexual assault. What is it about our society that reinforces the notion that anyone coming forward is automatically lying? Why do we dismiss that so quickly?
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to La Crosse, where Mark is on the line. Mark, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, several years ago, as a physician, I was falsely accused of inappropriate sexual conduct by a woman, and it was actually investigated by the state. And it was a horrific time during my life. It actually occurred during the Anita Hill hearings, and when all was said and done, the police were involved. I was asked to take a lie detector test, which my lawyer said not to take. And when all was said and done, the woman at the end of the day apologized and recanted her story. And I think it affected my wife more deeply than me. And at the time, we were told need to believe claims like this without evidence. We're told to believe Anita Hill. My wife was furious and said, no, we don't need to believe Anita Hill. We need to believe the facts. And when I heard your guest say just now that the woman coming forward, Dr. Ford, needs to be believed because in absence of any corroboration, she just needs to be believed because somebody finds her a compelling story, is just dangerous. And seriously, the things I'm listening to, you only hear these things from academics on college campuses. I'm not hearing the real world described here much at all, and I think much of what I'm hearing is outright dangerous, to be honest with you. It's not very reasoned. It's not very intellectual. It's not very appropriate. Now, due process is for everybody, not for select individuals.
All right, Mark, we get it. Thank you. I want to give Kelly a chance to respond.
Yeah, and again, we've heard a lot of this conversation, right, that we should be really concerned with false reports. And I want to go back to science. I want to go back to evidence, right? If we look at how often false reporting happens, there's a 2 to 8% chance of police reports of rape that are unfounded in some way. But we treat it in our culture as if there is a 50% chance that she could be lying. So absolutely, we should be circumspect in putting serious accusations in the world without fact-checking. I mean, we need to do that. This is why Dr. Ford asked for an FBI investigation. I think she wanted this process. She wanted this to make sure that due diligence happened. And so, again, we need to be aware of that, absolutely. But the unfortunate consequence of assuming that this happens all the time is that it makes people think that there are a lot more false accusations than there actually are, and that women just lie at the drop of the hat. So when a celebrity is accused of rape, the immediate thought is that a woman is looking for a quick payday, that she wants a settlement. And sure, maybe this happens once in a while, but it's kind of absurd to think that this is a good, like, get-rich-quick scheme to have sex with a celebrity and then wake up the next morning and say that it was assault and wanting to go through that. And so, again, it's just not something that most people do. Overwhelmingly, if you're worried about false accusations, you are far more likely to be sexually assaulted than to be falsely accused. Like, the numbers just don't support that. We tend to think that false accusations happen a lot more often than they do because they are highly publicized. There's a lot more media attention when there is a false accusation and when that is prosecuted. And so just understanding how often this happens, again, when a survivor comes forward, it really doesn't tend to be a he said, she said. According to science, there's a 90% chance that she's telling the truth. If a second allegation of rape surfaces, the science tells us the likelihood is 98%. The rare cases of false report kind of fit into two categories. So teens either lying to get into trouble or people with mental health issues. Dr. Ford is neither of those cases. So do false reports happen? Yes, but they're so rare, and I know that doesn't comfort anyone who has gone through this, and I'm sorry that he went through this. That's a horrible thing to have happened to you, and please know I hear that, and I'm not advocating that we have no process. I think one thing that has been sort of misunderstood, when we say believe women and believe survivors, that is not saying that we should automatically convict a man of sexual assault beyond a reasonable doubt. No one is saying that. That's the standard of a criminal trial involving presentation of evidence on both sides. In this case, it just means taking the victim seriously. Believing women is just not a reflexively sort of thing that we are thinking about here. It's the idea that we understand how shockingly normal it is for women to be sexually assaulted, that maybe we should take her seriously and do our thorough due process with this. But I think we need to be better about having a more thoughtful conversation about who we're asking to believe in this process, right? And so, yes, do false reports happen? Absolutely. But you are more likely to be struck by lightning than falsely accused. I mean, even the 2 to 8% of false reports, there are more people currently saying that their cars are stolen than coming forward with false accusations. And so just looking at the numbers here, there are far more people who are being sexually assaulted and never reporting than there are being falsely accused.
Mark, thanks for your call. I want to take a quick call, and then we'll get Kelly Will's response after the news. Chris is calling us from a small town in Wisconsin. Chris, tell us your story quickly, please.
Yeah, I have a friend who was sexually assaulted by her uncle when she was 12, and she never told anyone, and the effects on her life were unbelievable. Well, she did finally tell, and after she told, her aunt believed her and going to file charges against him. He ended up committing suicide and writing a letter apologizing, saying that he couldn't control himself, he knew what he was wrong. But the sad thing is that he did this to many other girls, and now she's going through hell because she didn't tell, and she feels like she ruined all these people's lives because she didn't come forward, and she was only 12.
And Chris, thank you for sharing that story. And Kelly Wills, when we continue our discussion, let's maybe talk a little bit about what Chris had to say and how sexual assault has effects beyond firsthand abuse. We're talking about the subject of sexual assault and how it's reported or not reported. We want to know what you've seen and what you've experienced at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Our discussion will continue. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Women who survived sexual assault are coming forward decades after their attacks. Our guest is a professor who analyzes what's prompting people to speak out, how we respond to these stories, and whether our understanding of trauma is changing. How do your friends and family talk about it? Do you think they take it seriously enough? Do you feel like they truly understand the impact it has on survivors? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kelly Wills is an associate professor in the Division of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. She teaches communication, gender, sexuality, and women's studies. Kelly, we had a caller this morning who talked about her friend's experience with an uncle who sexually assaulted her. Once she told, he killed himself, and that had a significant effect on the friend and her family. It's clear that sexual assault has effects beyond firsthand abuse. What role does guilt play in the way we think about sexual assault?
So this is a really big factor, and part of this goes back to, again, why many don't report. If it's a family member, again, are you wanting to upend your family's life in terms of reporting this or reporting to a family member maybe who's doing the assaulting? And so it's really slim a chance that you are going to come forward. And when we do, the levels of, you know, PTSD are incredibly high amongst rape survivors. And so most likely people are having issues with sleeping, nightmares, severe anxiety, numbness, depression. Sometimes they can last for months or even years or decades. I mean, you saw with Dr. Ford's testimony, I mean, this haunted her for years and affected even the way that she wanted to build her home. And so, again, that absolutely has lasting effects. And even with treatment, they can still have, you know, people can have panic attacks and things like that over time. Rape victims are much more likely to experience long-lasting mental and physical problems. Women who are raped suffer from much higher levels of sexual dysfunction, including pain during intercourse, menstrual issues, chronic pelvic pain, and inhibited arousal. And so there are a number of ways in which this affects everyone, and again, how awful this can be. Not only was she assaulted, but then all these other awful things happened to her. My heart goes out to the caller and her family that took place. And I'm hoping that she has the support she needs right now during this time.
Well, and the additional thing that our caller mentioned was that her friend then later felt really guilty about not going forward earlier because she discovered that this had happened to other girls, and she thought maybe if she'd reported it earlier, this could have been prevented.
Absolutely. I mean, again, a lot of times victims internalize this, right? One of the reasons we don't come forward is because of the shame that is associated with being sexually assaulted, right? And so we often view ourselves as sort of damaged goods or things like that. And so we internalize that, and then the guilt, right, of knowing that this person went out and did this again, and maybe I could have stopped that. And we can't go back in time, right? But that absolutely, it haunts us. And we wonder, had we stepped in earlier, maybe that wouldn't have happened to someone else. And right now, I mean, we the law has changed under the Clery Act now. So on campus, I'm now a mandatory reporter for that reason. So again, if a student comes to me and tells me that they were sexually assaulted and they hadn't report, I now am a mandatory reporter so that, again, if it's happening in the home, I can make sure that that's not happening to a sibling. And it's one of the laws I support because, again, we need to make sure that when this happens that we are doing due diligence to make sure that this is sorted out, that the perpetrator is not reoffending and doing this again. And our safety of our students is our top concern.
Let's take another phone call. This time we'll hear from Mike, who's calling us from Dodgeville this morning. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I was sexually assaulted as a little boy by a female babysitter, and I never would have really known that I was assaulted had my mother not asked questions. And anyway, she never reported the incident. And I just want to put it out there that it's not always women that are assaulted. And it just kind of seems that we're not touching on the other end of things. So that's
Mike, thank you for sharing your story with us. Kelly?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is really, really important to understand that, again, even though men are the primary people who are doing the sexual assaulting, victims can come from any background. And so, again, 99% of rapes are committed by men, of other women and of other men. And so there are large numbers of men who never come forward because of the shame associated with being sexually assaulted. We see this a lot. Again, I had a male student of mine come to me and talk to me, and I was the first person that he had reported to ever because we had been talking about rape culture in class, and he realized that what had happened to him was absolutely a sexual assault. But again, the idea that I was the first person that he could confide in, I'm happy that I could be there for him. But again, there is so much stigma when we talk about male survivors. Absolutely, men can be sexually assaulted and are sexually assaulted, and we need to take that seriously and make it make our culture a safer one where men feel comfortable reporting that. And so I'm very happy that he brought this subject up, and I'm devastated. I'm so sorry that happened to you. That is awful.
We've talked about why people don't always report sexual assault. Perhaps the bigger question here is, why is sexual assault happening in the first place? How do we, why is that? I mean, why do we do it? Why does this happen?
I think we need to start younger in terms of talking about healthy intimacy. One of my good friends said, I'm really worried for my son right now. I'm worried he's going to be falsely accused. And I sort of just asked her, you know, what kinds of conversation are you having with him about sex education, about consent? Are you talking to him about, you know, what consent looks like? You know, are you telling him or reminding him that if he's too drunk or to drive a car, he's probably too drunk to give consent? And so I think the more honest conversations we are having with our children, the better this will be. And oftentimes it's not going to happen in school, right, in terms of comprehensive sexual education. But if we can start at home and have open and honest conversations with our children about this and tell them, again, what boundaries look like, maybe, and not forcing them to give a hug to someone they don't want to give a hug to, right, and having earlier conversations around consent. So I have an amazing yoga instructor, and she has little consent cards even on the yoga mats to see, are you comfortable with me touching your body during yoga? And some people are and some people are not comfortable, right, to be able to flip that card over and say yes or no so she can help adjust you if you're doing something incorrectly. That's really great, right? I mean, there are ways in which we can talk about consent in better and more applied ways that will really intervene and get to the root cause of this, right? If we look back, even in the Brock Turner case, right, this is a swimmer who had raped an unconscious woman behind a dumpster. There were two men from Sweden who intervened because they recognized that what was happening was a sexual assault. One of the reasons for that is that Sweden does a really great job of talking about comprehensive sex education from a very early age. And so young people there have a much better language to talk about this than we do in the United States.
Kelly Wills teaches communication at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. She's with us. We're talking about sexual assault this hour on The Morning Show. We sometimes process the world around us through comedy. Here's a moment from an episode of Saturday Night Live. Several people are having a nice time at dinner until someone brings up an op-ed that accuses comedian Aziz Ansari of sexual misconduct. People at the table reluctantly agree to talk about it, and here's what happens.
Well, let's come to this. I'll go first. Are you sure you want to do this?
Yes, yes, I will speak on the topic of Aziz Ansari. I think...
Careful.
Yeah, I think that some women... Careful. Or rather, some men have a proclivity... Help me.
Kelly, this was supposed to make people laugh, but it shows how uncomfortable we are talking about sexual assault. What did you think about the sketch?
Absolutely. So this is one of my favorites, and because it highlights how hard it is to have these conversations, right? And because we tend to not have open and honest conversations about sexual assault, period, we just don't have the language to talk about it at all, right? And so the more we can understand and learn about these issues, the more we can be open and honest about these conversations, about how often sexual assault happens, how to prevent it, bystander intervention, the better we are able to have those conversations. I mean, one of the difficulties here is anytime someone who is accused belongs to a member of your political party, we are just, in general, less likely to be objective, right? So what I'm noticing, even in this past week, that some of the men who were defending Al Franken when he was accused of sexual misconduct were now openly invested in critiquing rape culture, right, because this fits within their political narrative. I don't want us to only care about sexual assault and survivors when it's politically convenient. I want us to care always. And there's this fascinating study that highlights how voters could recognize that a politician is lying, but consider them authentic and appealing, even if they are lying, because it fits their worldview, right? I think we tend to, when it's someone from our own party, look past any sort of misconduct or allegations because it's just too important, right? We saw this with Bill Clinton on the left, to many coming to his defense because, again, there's just so much at stake. And so I would have people sort of walk back if you're really defending someone or, think about, again, how much does your political bias play into this in terms of how you are defending that person or reinforcing their behavior? Would you care as much if that person was just a celebrity versus a political person in a political position? And so I think in general, we tend to have not great conversations, but they become even worse when it becomes really highly politicized.
Christine Blasey Ford is a woman, Brett Kavanaugh is a man, but let's say a man was accusing a female Supreme Court nominee. How might this conversation be different? And we might have to continue this conversation about this question in just a moment, but give me the quick answer here if you've got one.
Oh, gosh. I mean, the dynamics would change, right? We tend to have, in general, Kate Mann uses the term himpathy to describe when men are accused of sexual assault. Because we tend to identify with the perpetrator over the victim. Honestly, I mean, this would look very different because the dynamics have changed. But I mean, one instance of this is in NYU, a female professor was accused by her male subordinate. And so again, we had to sort of, rethink the ways in which we look at how power works terms of who is in power. And so if that sort of gets to your answer a little bit as well.
Yeah, we'll continue this conversation in this line in just a moment. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Women who survived sexual assault are coming forward decades after their attacks. Our guest is a professor who analyzes what's prompting people to speak out now, how we respond to these stories, and whether our understanding of trauma is changing. What do you think about the way we address the issue of sexual assault? What do you hope will come out of today's conversations? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kelly Wills is an associate professor in the Division of Communication at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. She teaches communication, gender, sexuality, and women's studies. Today, more women are telling their stories of sexual assault. What's changed in our culture that's allowed more women to come forward in a way maybe they couldn't have in the past?
I think social media is huge, right? I mean, there was no Twitter when Anita Hill was giving her testimony, right? And so I think people visually seeing how often this happens, I mean, one of the reasons the Me Too movement went as far as it did was that it was impossible not to see your friends talking about their own experiences with sexual assault and abuse, right? Because, again, you're depending on you know, where you are, but it was impossible not to see people that you know and love saying, yeah, I've experienced this, me too, right? And, again, with the hashtag why I didn't report, people seeing, oh, my gosh, how often this happens, that I was assaulted but I didn't report because of these reasons. And so I think visually seeing that and knowing how often this happens, too, there are a number of studies that show that when we can visually see how much this takes place, when people are witnesses to that, we tend to understand it as a much larger problem than maybe we assumed beforehand. So social media plays a huge role in this.
And this also, we've got a couple of examples coming up here of men who've been sexually assaulted. Here, I want to read this email, and then we have a phone call because these are related, and I'd like to take them together.
Sure.
We had an email from Eric. He writes, I was the victim of a very frightening sexual assault at the hands of a male family friend at 15. I reported it to my parents immediately, but they chose not to report the assault or ever speak of it again. It destroyed my life in many aspects. I don't know the month or date, but I vividly recall the details and location. Eric writes, this happened in 1977. If I were to report it today, I'm sure the accuser would deny it. I know what happened and he knows what happened. Who would you believe? So that's Eric's email. Now let's take a call from Robert in Mondovi. Robert, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call and truly thank you for having this conversation. I too was a male sexual assault survivor when I was 11. It was a male lifeguard, and from the aspect of not being able to remember details, absolutely, it happened over several occasions, and the guilt and the shame and everything that went with that, I didn't report, and it wasn't a conscious decision to not report. As an adult looking back on that experience, I've kind of classified it as saying it almost happened to somebody else. I was so removed from those events, it was like it didn't happen to me. My abuser was eventually arrested and convicted in 2000. So after 25 years of abusing kids, I found out that one of his victims committed suicide. And I owned that boy's death for years because I felt that maybe if I'd have reported in 1976, it would have changed the outcome. I believe now that that's not completely accurate. 76 was a different time than it is today, as your expert has said. But I've never been questioned on the truth of my assault. And I think it's sad that men typically are not accused of being liars, where women are. But I just wanted to say thank you. And as a survivor, I appreciate the conversation being had.
Robert, thank you for sharing your story. Let's address this issue. Kelly Wills?
I first want to thank the callers that are calling in today and sharing their stories, and thank you for being so brave and courageous to do that. That is really, really hard to do. And to the survivors out there, too, who do not feel comfortable sharing their stories as well, like, please know that that is okay. I guess, again, this week, for many reasons, has been heartbreaking. Hearing more stories from more friends of mine who have been assaulted and who've gone through this, I think we need to be aware of how often this happens and how regularly this happens and how much of a serious issue this is. To your last caller's point, we have a long history of not believing women. No one says you can't trust them, but we do distrust them. A college student in their survey revealed that they think that their female peers lie 50% of the time when it comes to rape and assault. Even when we look at rape, too, rape is the only crime in which we put the onus on the victim to prove their story. If someone went into your house and stole your TV, no one would ask you how much you were drinking or what you were wearing. When the victims of sexual assault are children, you don't ask how much they were drinking, how much they were wearing, right? But somehow when they are adults, we assume that somehow they brought this on themselves. That kind of victim-blaming mentality makes it even harder for any anyone to report a sexual assault. And so I want us to be aware of how often we blame the victim, how often we put the onus on victims to prove themselves in these stories without realizing that we have a really huge problem with sexual assault in this country. Again, just looking at the numbers, right, 1 in 5 or 1 in 13, if 1 in 13 planes crashed, we would probably address that problem. We wouldn't just let this continue to happen. And yet when it comes to sexual assault, we assume it's just a rite of passage. The way it's just been normalized in our culture, I think, is what makes me so upset and angry.
Let's take a call from Aaron in La Crosse next. Aaron, you're on the morning show.
Hello, good morning. I appreciate this discussion that we're having. I wanted to ask the guest if she could comment on some of the research about rape culture, because I've been through a lot of the training as a social worker on rape culture, and I don't really think that the research supports the idea of rape culture. I think it's more of an opinion. And I actually think that what we're seeing is more of an example of hookup culture rather than rape culture.
So the two can go hand in hand. I would highly suggest for anyone who wants to be better on these conversations, Kate Harding has an amazing book called Asking For It, and she breaks down all the sort of rape myths that our culture entails. So she has an entire chapter on false accusations. She has an entire chapter about the ways in which women are taught to prevent themselves from being raped. And so, you know, one of the ideas is that, you know, it's our responsibility to carry the rape whistles and to make sure that we walk in pairs and a number of things that we are supposed to do to prevent ourselves from being raped versus that looking at why does sexual assault keep happening, right? And so along with those victim blame mentalities, there's a large body of research out there that talks about rape myths, how rape myths even linger into the juror process. And so because so many jurors believe or have a tendency to understand what quote-unquote real rape victims look like or how they behave, it's incredibly hard to prosecute the survivors of sexual assault because we have so many sort of misinformation. It's gotten so bad now that even judges sort of warn jurors to not draw on these rape myths when making decisions at a trial. And so even when a judge permits evidence that challenges these myths, that cannot possibly compete with the bombardment of prejudice and misinformation that jurors tend to absorb from our culture. And so if we look at even the criminal justice process, because people assume that she was asking for it or that rape victims were bringing this on themselves, it's really hard for them to identify with the victim, and more often they identify with the accused.
We've got just less than 2 minutes left and so much more to talk about here, but if people disagree with the way we deal with sexual assault today, where do they start to affect change?
Talking to your kids. I think, again, parents have a huge role in this in terms of talking about what does healthy intimacy look like? How can we make it so that more sexual interactions can be less gray. You know, looking for affirmative consent, checking in with your partner, making sure that again you understand that and caring about their pleasure as well. If we really cared about everyone's pleasure and every single sexual behavior that occurred, it would be really difficult to have, you know, rape or assault, because again, if you're actually thinking about someone as fully human and autonomous, you want them to have a pleasurable outcome in that scenario. And so I would say, again, having open conversations about this, not being afraid to talk about this. If there are survivors in your family, listening to them and hearing their stories. But there's a lot we can do in terms of just having franker and more honest discussions about this with our members of our family.
Kelly Wills, thank you for joining me this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Kelly Wills is an associate professor in the Division of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. She teaches communication, gender, sexuality, and women's studies. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.